Chief Justice, judges, may it please the court. Article 1, Section 2 of the Missouri Constitution provides that trial by jury, as heretofore enjoyed, shall remain inviolate. The true function of the jury is to determine the facts in a case and reach a fair and just verdict, including damages. That was the role of the jury in 1820 and a function the people of this state and their constitution retained for 12 of their number to perform without interference, and they did so for 185 years. Now, this must remain the jury's function if the right to trial by jury, as heretofore enjoined, shall remain inviolate. Lillian Llewellyn's right to a trial by jury on her common law claim for fraudulent misrepresentation, in which she sought actual and punitive damages, attaches, and is set forth in this court in Scott versus Blue Springs Ford. There's no question that punitive damages and exemplary damages, as well as actual damages, were recognized under the common law in 1820. Section 510.265, by capping or limiting those punitive damages, and in this case of Lillian Llewellyn, eliminating $500,000 of an amount of punitive damages that had been determined by a jury, violates her constitutional right of trial by jury, and her right to trial by jury is not inviolate. Now
that this is because fraud is common law and not a statutory remedy as per MPPA, right?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. Fraudulent misrepresentation, as this court indicated in Scott versus Blue Springs Ford, was one of those cases under the common law tort of trespass that was tried by juries in 1820. And it is unlike the Missouri Merchandising Practice Act, which is a statutory cause of action, as well as psychological death, which is also a statutory cause of action.
Counsel, I know you'll get to this, but unlike actual damages, there's more of a due process component to the amount of punitive damages. And opposing counsel's brief stresses that and suggests that the U.S. Supreme Court has put limits on the amount of punitive damages based upon due process, and that's what this statute is attempting to do by legislation, to legislate kind of the limits of due process as being five times actuals or $500,000, and that therefore the analysis of this court in Watts doesn't entirely apply because we've already recognized you can limit the amount of punitives in a way you can't actuals because through due process, and that's really what the statute did here, or alternatively the evidence supports here. Can you address if you agree that there's those due process limits and whether those can be imposed by statute?
We agree that there are due process limits. That is a historical function that the judiciary retains on punitive damage awards, is to determine under the provisions of due process whether or not it met the award met certain standards. But we believe that is a different standard of review and a different procedure than the legislator's arbitrary cap of imposing an amount of $500,000 in this case here without regard to the facts, without regard to the harm that was actually occurred by the plaintiff in the case. When there is a due process analysis, Your Honors, the court, under the guidepost of Gore and under its further application in Campbell, the courts did have to look at the facts of the case by determining the reprehensibility of the party, the disparity between the actual harm and the punitive award, and finally how the punitive award may compare to a civil claim. So in a due process analysis, unlike the legislature in this statute, which imposed an arbitrary cap or limit, the due process analysis, after the jury award has attached and the right has attached, did review it under its judiciary prerogative of remittiture by determining as the facts of that particular case whether it applies.
I know one thing they noted is that in suggesting that often, especially with a large award, four or five, single-digit multiplier is appropriate, often four or five times the amount. They looked at what limits legislators had put on or what fines had been imposed and so forth. Opposing counsel argues the Supreme Court considered legislative action in determining what limits due process would have. Can you address that, or are they sort of taking a concept and putting it in an inappropriate setting? Or
I think they are taking the concept it's not a fair application to this case here or analysis of punitive damages, because the courts have consistently said, even though there may be guideposts as to address the punitive damages, there is no fine, bright light measure that defines a specific ratio that the court must apply. And that's why the court, particularly in Campbell, which this court followed and addressed in Blue Springs Ford versus Scott versus Blue Springs Ford, that there is no fine, bright light that exists, and it depends on the facts of the case, particularly in a case such as this where actual damages may be rather small, as is very typical in most consumer cases. And so therefore the ratio or the formula is not as applicable in those types of cases as it may be in a larger setting.
Mr. Nolan, is it certain that 510-265 applies to this case, that it applies to a common law cause of action? Isn't it possible to read the statute as applying only to statutory causes of action?
Well, that would be that is the appellate's position, is that 510-265 violates the constitutional right that she has in her common law cause of action.
But only if it applies to her common law cause of action.
Well, it.
What if the court was just wrong to apply these caps, and a proper construction of the statute is, particularly in light of all of the references in subsection 2 of the statute, a proper construction is that it only applies to statutory causes of action?
Well, I guess then Mrs. Llewellyn would get her additional $500,000, and I probably wouldn't.
You would lose interest quickly, wouldn't you?
I
you don't need to answer that question.
I have a question. I don't understand this transaction at all. I mean, how did the defrauder, so to speak, why did they do that? I mean, she paid $59, he makes up the difference for 3 months, and then they take the car. Where was the money advantage to the defrauder, so to speak?
What were the actual damages?
Why did they do this? I don't understand this whole thing of getting her to buy this car, $70,000 car for $59, and they made up the difference of the $350 for 3 months and then stopped, and then they repossessed the car. What's the advantage to anyone on that?
Well, this is part of a large, what we contend was a sophisticated advertising campaign that existed throughout the Kansas City metropolitan area over a number of years that defrauded literally hundreds of consumers. The advertising claim was that a person could purchase a car for a small amount of money on a monthly payment, and then the balance would somehow be absorbed by the dealership, and they would in turn write a check back to the consumer for the difference in what their payment would have been and the $49.
Oh, so the consumer would be seeing the... And sort of morally be obligated, so to speak, to keep paying it afterwards. That was
the actual contract required payment of a far, far larger amount than the consumer, according to the allegations, was told they would have to pay. It didn't require $49. It required thousands of dollars.
Right. But the consumers were all told by the dealers and by Chad Franklin that this $49 would be all that they would pay.
Is the constitutional question what the legislature could have done at the time that the constitutional provision was adopted in 1820, or what they were doing?
I think that has been addressed by the courts that the what is the right to a trial by jury as heretofore enjoined meant those causes of action that existed at common law in 1820 at the time of the adoption of the Constitution.
Or if it's an analogous action today, like this is analogous to trespass.
Yes.
And I guess my question is one question behind that, in the sense of assuming any common law cause of action, is the constitutional question whether the legislature could have passed any statutes which modify the damage award at that time, or whether they had statutes that modified jury's awards at that time?
I'm not sure I quite understand your question.
Well, as I understand your argument is that the legislature, based on a couple of recent cases, that the legislature can cap statutory causes of action but not common law causes of action, right? I mean, that's a
that's correct.
Short
yes.
summary of your argument. And so, and my question is the question what the legislature could have done to common law causes of action at 1820 the real root question? I mean, your assumption is that they couldn't have modified. I mean, your assumption is that they could not have modified a damage award by legislative enactment at that time.
Or is your argument that whatever it was, whether they could have or not in 1820, once we adopted a constitutional provision freezing that in place, that after that they couldn't modify it?
Yes. I mean, the appellate submit that once the constitutional right to trial by jury attaches, it becomes inviolate.
Right. It locked it in time at 1820.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in 1820, there were no statutory caps. There were no statutory limitations on the jury's true function and ability to determine liability and what the amount of damages was to be, because that was the true function of the jury in 1820, to determine liability and damages.
Are you aware of any statutes at that time that were affirmed by the Missouri Supreme Court that did allow for legislative modification of damage awards?
In 1820 or up to the present time?
No, at 1820.
Not in 1820.
Now, I kind of agreed with the dissent in Overbay. I was just a question as far as now you won't affect your case necessarily because you're saying it's common law, but is there an argument that the state can't do an umbrella punitive, they have to address each statute like wrongful death or MPPNA as far as limiting damages versus an umbrella punitive damages statute that would limit damages for everything from Doe Run to MPNA?
Well, that's if I can answer that question that way, it seems like this court in Sanders, which was looking at a wrongful death statutory cause of action, Judge Price there said that the General Assembly may negate a cause of action or the remedies that did not exist prior to 1820, but following that would not be able to do so on any cause of action that existed before 1820 or at the time of 1820. And to our argument is that the legislature may be able to change remedies that they create, like the wrongful death statute or the Missouri Merchandising Practice Act. But I think under the premise of Sanders that was upheld in Watts is that the legislature can only change remedies that did not exist in 1820, and the legislature cannot change what it did not create. And that's why in Watts, and we believe the Watts is the logical extension of our relief that we're requesting here in Llewellyn, is that a statutory cap that's applied to common law cause of action is unconstitutional, as it causes a limitation on the constitutional right to a trial by jury as set forth in Article 1, Section 22.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you. May it please the court. We're essentially here to resolve a question that was left unanswered by this court and the prior Overby decision. Does the CAF statute 510.265, is it unconstitutional when applied to common law claims? Now, Judge Wilson has raised the question whether we can interpret 510.265 that it just applies to statutory claims. For purposes of today's discussion, I just want to assume that it does apply to common law claims because I think that's the interesting issue we need to grapple with here today.
Well, but why do you assume we don't have to grapple with it at all if we can construe the statute consistent with the Constitution and say that it doesn't apply. So why is that an unreasonable or at least impossible construction of the statute?
Well, I don't think it's an impossible construction statute, but Judge, what I'm going to discuss here in the next few minutes is that the statute does not violate the Constitution. As Judge Teitelman said in the recent Watts decision, we have to look at what was the right of jury trial as in 1820. It's a historical analysis. And I think we need to be very careful here in importing modern conceptions of punitive damages, damages intended purely to punish and deter, from the concepts that existed in 1820. Now, this may not have been as clearly articulated in our brief as I would have liked, but when I came to law school, I kind of got the education that exemplary and punitive damages are one and the same thing. As I've dug deeper into that question, I've realized that, wait a minute, the concept of exemplary damages in 1820 was something very different than we consider that today. Specifically, this court needs to look at two decisions that weren't cited in the brief, but were issued by this court. For example, in 1865, in Freidenhardt versus Edmondson, which is 36 Missouri Reporter 226, this court stated that, or discussed what are referred to as, quote, the more unsettled question, close quote, of whether a jury can, quote, award merely vindictive and punitory damages by way of punishing the defendant rather than compensatory. And we are not to be understood as sanctioning the principle which by the nature of it would seem to belong rather to the domain of criminal than civil jurisprudence. Later in 1867, in McKeon versus Citizens Railway Company, 42 Missouri 79, this court stated, it is at least very questionable upon principle and authority whether damages for punishment can be given in any civil action. Again, 1867. 47 years after the 1820 Missouri Constitution.
And did they mean punitive damages by that? What was the context in which that was said?
In that context, they were referring to a debate which was raging among law professors and courts around the mid-1800s with regard to the distinctions between different categories of damages. At common law, there were nominal damages, what referred to as usually as compensatory damage, and then exemplary damages. And at common law, well, we won't deal with nominal damages, that's really not our issue here, but compensatory damages at common law were out-of-pocket, pecuniary harms. Whereas exemplary damages, if you look at the cases, discuss damages for things like injury to reputation, hurt feelings, disgrace, things that maybe in the modern era we would conceive of as components of non-economic damages that we today think of as part of actual damages, but aren't pecuniary damages. And what I think if you look at the case law, there is a shift that occurred sometime between the late 1700s, early 1800s, and then gelled sometime in the latter half of the 1800s, is that the concept of damages for these intangible things that were exemplary damages became divorced from that concept and became its own level, own separate entity, non-economic damages. And the concept of damages purely to punish was not a concept that existed at common law in 1820. Rather, the concept of adding these additional non-economic harms as a component of damages
but
was
then
itself
in the mid-1900s, then in the mid-1900s, about there became the evolution of consumer law where, for example, in Truth in Lending, the damages may not have been any damages at all, be $1,000, but you get $500,000 in class action relief when the Truth in Lending Act passed in 69. So the whole idea was the private attorney general concept from the federal courts and the state courts, and with the evolution of MP&A cases, was that you want to stop certain conduct, the attorney general can't bring them all, and you have private attorney generals who can bring those cases for individuals, and they then can get quote unquote exemplary or punitive damages.
I agree. That is part of the evolution of law, that since 1820, we've recognized a role for punitive damages and to punish a defendant that was not.
So you're saying we won't find any place in the common law that damages were used to punish or deter fraudulent conduct or other intentional misconduct back in the 1820s?
Your Honor, I would submit that the concept here, as far as damages purely for punishment, was something that was not present at common law.
Punish and deter
misconduct. Rather,
that
the primary purpose of damages was to compensate. Early, it was just for pecuniary losses, then through the doctrine of exemplary damages to compensate for these intangible things that they couldn't put a dollar figure to or wasn't a physical harm. And by allowing that, they considered that to be somewhat of a punishment value as well, by holding the person responsible for more than just the physical harm they caused. But the concept of something as pure punishment, damages just for that purpose, and not
to compensate. So you're telling me if I go back and do research on the law prior to 1820 in under the common law in the United States or in England at that time, I won't find that they were used for what we would now consider punitive purposes, are you saying that they were seldom awarded for that, and more often it was for intangibles, or are you saying they didn't exist for that purpose at all?
I think you will find some confusion on that issue because terminology was used somewhat indistinctly and imprecisely in some of these cases. But if there is an exhaustive summary of sort of this evolution that I located, and it's a non-Missouri case. It's a case, Fay versus Parker. It's from the New Hampshire Supreme Judicial Court, 53 NH342. It's an 1872 decision. Not from this court.
For that and the other sites that aren't in your brief, you'll send us a letter, an opposing counsel letter.
Certainly. But that case is good from the perspective of it provides a fairly exhaustive collection of these cases and tries to interpret them as to what this concept of exemplary damages is, and did that concept embrace a purely punitive function, or was it, as I'm arguing here today and as discussed by this court in the two prior decisions I've discussed, is that it was that exemplary damages were at their core compensatory, not primarily intended to punish, but instead to compensate the plaintiff who was before the court.
Now, I think our jurisprudence would say it should be more difficult to get punitive damages. We haven't barred them, at least in this century or the last century. In the last century and this century, people are beginning. But you have to show a higher burden, but you have to show the submissible case and that the punitive damage is not so much as exemplary as much as to stop an action from happening, or maybe exemplary that other defrauders won't do the same thing.
Well, certainly the role of exemplary damages, I understand in trying to analyze these mid-1800 cases, is that we're going to allow you extra compensation for these intangible harms because of the degree of wrongdoing of the other side. But we're still doing it for compensation, not to punish. And so the issue here...
Although in this state, actually, with the Tort Victims Fund, only half the money would go to the plaintiff. The other half goes to a tort victims fund, which is not compensatory.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is a split between where the money goes if there is a punitive damages award. So to kind of bring this back to the core here, the question is, was there a right to jury trial in 1820 to have a jury award damages purely for the purposes of punishment? Based on the cases I've just discussed, I don't think you can reach that conclusion. It was unsettled as of 1820.
That's not what you just said, I don't think. I think you said that they would allow some kinds of damages to punish, right? And those were the exemplary damages.
I may have misspoken. The purpose of exemplary damages was to compensate, first and foremost. It may have had a punitive function attached to it, but it was at its core compensatory damages.
But they weren't allowed in every case. They were only allowed in cases of unconscionable conduct.
Correct. In the other cases, the damages were limited to pecuniary losses, physical damage. There was no ability for a jury to compensate for disgrace.
damaged the reputation, hurt feelings.
But they could do that where there was a reason to punish, right?
But that was not the purpose of those. But as I read these cases, that was not the purpose of exemplary damages, first and foremost. It was to compensate. And that its character, if it had any punitive function, it was purely incidental. And that there wasn't a right for a jury to determine, as in 1820, that it could award damages purely for the purposes of punishing. And if there was no right in 1820 to such an award, then it makes perfect sense how the legislature can now, in 2013, adopt laws that limit the ability to recover punitive damages. Because if the right did not, to jury trial did not exist to that issue as of 1820, the legislature has a role to...
What if the court were ultimately to disagree with your argument and find that it was permitted, or this comes within the concept of exemplary damages as understood in 1820? Then do you concede that the reasoning of Watts applies here?
I would not say Watts is still on all fours with this case, because as you alluded in your questions to Mr. Nolan, that we're dealing with a different situation here than in Watts. Here we have a situation where the U.S. Supreme Court has said that there are limits on punitive damages as a matter of constitutional due process rights.
Have they said that in intentional tort cases? Is there an intentional tort case that says that? Or are those just negligence cases?
As far as the U.S. Supreme Court's precedents, I believe most of them are dealing with consumer-type issues, and I don't believe off the top of my head, with the possible exception of the Exxon case, that right. They've dealt specifically with an intentional tort issue.
But they gave out guidelines, and Exxon the Exxon case and the... They said, well, usually it shouldn't be more than 10, but it didn't say that was an absolute. And the same thing with the State Farm case. They didn't say it was an absolute. They wanted to pull back on punitive damages, but they didn't say you couldn't have them. You had factors.
Well, certainly the Exxon case suggests that the actual limit is 1-to-1, at least on a large actual damages award. But certainly, I will agree that as of this point, they have not set a bright line rule that punitive damages cannot exceed a ratio of X to Y. They've certainly repeatedly said where the boundary likely lies, but they've not put their foot down and said, okay, this is a limit beyond which you cannot cross. But at the same time, having provided that guidance, it makes sense for the legislature to have some role in defining what those penalties might be. Certainly, historically, the legislature has had a role in creating statutory penalties as well.
Do we let the legislature define due process, or is that just inherently a judicial function?
I think the legislature can have a role in shaping, or at least trying to establish some standards. Now,
they establish process, but isn't the court to say whether it's the process that's due?
Certainly it is the role of the courts to determine what due process is. But that doesn't mean that there is no role for the legislature in providing assistance. Let me draw a little bit of analogy. It may be a little far afield. But in the context of the unauthorized practice of law, this court has a number of decisions says that this court is the sole authority of what is the unauthorized practice of law. Yet we have a statute out there which sets the penalties for committing the unauthorized practice of law. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that this court can go afield from that statute. The legislature stepped in and said, this is the penalty for that conduct, and this is how it should be shaped. In the same way, I think, here where we've got the legislature historically ascribing penalties for conduct in various forms, that there is a role for the legislature to play in this process. It doesn't violate the separation of powers in that regard. If there's no right to a jury trial for punitive damages, it certainly doesn't upset any existing due process rights.
As recently as the well-reasoned Berry versus Volkswagen, the court in that case analyzed the Supreme Court's guidelines in Purdue and giving it due deference to decline to follow those guidelines in Purdue. So we have the option, we can decide as outside the legislation whether we accept the Supreme Court's guidelines or not.
Well, I'm I'm not sure if this court can deviate from what the highest court of the land has said in interpreting the United States Constitution.
Sure, but we don't apply those guidelines in that case.
But certainly there is some flexibility in applying those guidelines, again, because the Supreme Court has not set a bright line rule. I only have a few seconds left. Just want to briefly touch upon our cross appeal. I think there are two issues the court does need to take some careful consideration of. First, the issue of repeated conduct. There's been some unclarity in the rules, but we insist that the principle here is on repeat, not merely repeated conduct, but conduct that is sequential after complaints have arisen or after violations have occurred. And second, with regard to the issue of comparable civil penalties, there is a case that recently was decided by the Missouri Court of Appeals, Hecadon, that I think muddles the analysis, and I believe it's discussed in our briefing that their approach would essentially take that component, that guidepost of the State Farm analysis out of the test, and it shouldn't be followed here.
Mr. Linden, before you're seated, I want to revisit the Judge Wilson's question about 510-265, because if he's correct that statute doesn't apply, then you lose on appeal. Is that right?
If 510-265 does not apply to common law claims as a matter of statutory interpretation, then clearly I have no argument here.
So do you wish to make an argument that it does apply?
I don't think, and it wasn't briefed by the parties, but I don't think you can read from the text of the statute itself a limitation just to statutory claims. It does carve out some exceptions for certain types of claims, but I don't think you can infer from that the legislature just intended those caps to apply to statutory claims. And it may be a little absurd to look at it this way, but the statute was adapted as what was referred to as tort reform. Courts are not statutes. I think the intention was to apply to all claims, not just statutory claims.
But that would be the legislative intent, which we don't have a history on, as opposed to the constitutional requirement of 1820, if we go that way.
Again,
it wouldn't apply
different
to
issue.
The Constitution.
Yeah. Different issue. I was addressing Judge Wilson's query as to whether the statute can be read as applying just to statutory claims.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Before you sit down, do you want to address Judge Fisher's question? Should we be concerned with whether there were limits on punitive damages in 1820, setting aside your argument about exemplaries being different? Or should the question be whether there was a present but at that point unused power to cap damages at that time?
I think that's a very fine distinction, and I think it's the second of those that you need to direct your attention to. Certainly, whether or not statutory limitations on punitive damages, or any other type of damages for that matter, existed in 1820, informs us on the issue of whether or not there was legislative authority to do that. But even in the absence of such limitations, I think this court does need to consider whether the legislature had that authority as of 1820 to limit any type of damages, let alone here where we've got damages that are intended to be purely punitive and purely for the issue of punishment and not for compensation. So I think you do need
but
to look at those questions, but it's the second one which is most important.
But in subsequent constitutions, in 1945, they could have limited it if they wanted to.
Certainly, but they just essentially carry forward the same right as existed in 1820. They made no additional modifications.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Nolan, on the way up to the podium, I have a question for you. And again, I think I understand your argument. So take a common law cause of action such as trespass that we could all agree existed back at 1820. I think there's a statute on the books now that trespass to chattels. So if you cut trees down, there's a statute that says, for example, that you can get treble damage if they cut your trees. Would that be unconstitutional under your view because at the time the Constitution was adopted, you just got whatever damages were for trespass without any legislative trebling?
Um,
Our belief is that the legislature is not free to impose a cap or restriction or limitation on a cause of action that existed at common law.
I agree, and I guess what I'm trying to figure out is it what's fair for the goose is fair for the gander as it looks as we look at the Constitution. Otherwise, you're focused in on this case because of the nature of the case and the common law cause of action, that there's a legislative limitation on damages. And my question is, assume that a common law cause of action exists and the legislature would give a statutory ad, like trebling of damages for trespass to trees, cutting trees. Would that be unconstitutional under your view? Because again, the defendant would say, well, at common law, you didn't get treble damages. I want my right to jury trial that existed at common law. Well, you got whatever your damages were for the trespass to my trees, but you didn't get them times three. In other words, the jury decides the damage, but there's a statute that says times three. Your view of the Constitution, would that be unconstitutional or not?
Yes, I think it would be. I think if the right to trial by jury is to remain inviolate, and that means clear, free from any blemish, unbroken, then there cannot be any statutory infringement, no matter how great, no matter how small, because any measure that infringes upon that right to an inviolate right, in a sense, violates the right, in this case, of the constitutional right.
And the right applies to the defendant as well as the plaintiff. The defendant has the same right to the inviolate jury trial as the plaintiff has.
Correct. Yes, I agree.
So Judge, I think your answer is correct to Judge Fisher's question that the defendant could make an argument that he is entitled to the determination of damages that the jury makes, not a different number that the legislature wants.
All the courts have treated trebling of damages as not being compensatory or punitive. That's more like fine when it's a statutorily imposed treble damages. Or if it was treated that way, that would be a different issue because those are never for the jury.
But we also, in Dio and I think Blue Springs, we said even though the statute said the damages would be set by the court, we said you have a right to a jury trial because that was what was there in 1820. If you're given a right to that, you know, damage or whatever the damages were in MP&A and also in the Deal case, we said you have a right to a jury to decide that versus the court.
I would agree with that. I think this court, even back as far as 1855 in that Whitson v. Scott case, said that it was the jury that was the most appropriate judge of the amount of damages. They had the authority and they had the ability to determine the consequent of damages. And I think as the court has indicated, Judge Teitelman, in Deal, there was a very in-depth analysis of what these common law causes of action were. In Scott versus Blue Springs Ford, there was a clear analysis and an emphatic statement by the court that actual and punitive damages are those damages which were tried by jury at common law. And therefore, you know, we submit that Section 510.265 does violate Mrs. Llewellyn's right to trial by jury that is set forth in Article 1, Section 22 of her common law claim for actual and punitive damages for fraudulent misrepresentation, because that right to trial by jury that was guaranteed to her was not inviolate, but was in fact violated by the statute which limited this. We would submit that there is...
Counsel, you're out of time.
Okay.
Thank you. The matter will be taken under advisement.
Thank you very much. Thank you.